It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. On Wednesday, a shooting at a software company in Middleton left three people seriously injured, and the perpetrator was killed after police reached the scene. Authorities have identified the assailant as 43-year-old Anthony Tong, who illegally possessed a gun after his permit revoked in 2004 due to what was described as mental health issues. Those recovering now in the hospital are in fair condition. Christine Maltese is an employee at WTS Paradigm, and she was in the building during the shooting on Wednesday. I talked to her earlier today. Christine, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Ms. Ferret.
Well, first of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah?
I'm doing okay. Mm-hmm.
Are you in touch with your coworkers, talking about how people are reacting?
There is communication going back and forth, and it's open communication. So, yes, that is very helpful.
And can you talk us through your experience back on Wednesday?
It was a regular day, and it was, I had just finished a phone call. I was in a conference room, and just right before that, 3 hours before, I had wished the individual a good morning. He never spoke, the usual, just very quiet, introverted. I thought, oh, that's fine, you know, no big thing. I went about my day, and I had just finished a phone call with a customer. I was in a conference room, and I was about to stand up to go do something. I was like, no, I'll sit here, because there was 13 minutes before my next meeting. And as we're talking, we hear pop, pop, the third pop, and then I hear a yell, ah, and then another pop, and then another yell. And the one gentleman that I was in the room with, he went flying to turn off the lights. And I went running around to the other side of the table, and I had a black sweater. So I laid on my stomach so you couldn't see any color. And I'm trying to blend in with the chair and the table. And the gentleman that turned off the light, he barricaded the door with his body. And he called 911, and the operator couldn't hear him because we're trying to whisper, trying to be quiet. And as he's calling 911, I hear a pop, and the person fall and say, why? And then pop, and then why? And then he called out his girlfriend's name and said that he loved her. And then the third pop, and stayed quiet, very, very quiet. And there was a pause, and it felt like a long pause, but I couldn't give you the time. So we let, in the meantime, the call for 911, active shooter, and then the police, I heard the police come in. It seemed like it was forever, but apparently it was a very, very short time. And I heard them come running in and saying, police, police. And then from the sound, I could hear that they split up. And I heard a couple of them saying, we have shields, we have shields. There he is, there he is, there's a gunman, there's a gunman. And then they kept yelling at him, drop the gun, drop the gun, drop the gun. And he never said a word at any point during the whole time. And because he wouldn't drop it, the gunshots were so loud and so much, I covered my head, and we just stayed as quiet as possible. But right before that, I grabbed my phone and I sent the text message to my sister-in-law, letting her know, shooter, people killed, I didn't know, and I love you all. And I didn't know if that would be the last communication ever. So after the barrage of bullets ended, the gentleman behind the door called 911 again to say that we were in this room. And the police, within a minute or two, not even, they came to the door and then they escorted us out. And that's when we got across, the one policeman, I didn't realize I had hit my knee on the chair leg and I had trouble walking, but he helped me. And that's the picture that you see after I got out.
What's it like that picture has been in the news locally and around the country? What's it like in some ways being the face of the reaction to what happened there?
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to be what I call the poster person for that. It's a very difficult moment and a moment that you can't understand.
And what did you think of the police response and how they reacted and helped you out of the building?
Wonderful. I couldn't ask for anything better. They immediately took control. They weren't in, after the incident happened, they were very concerned about her well-being. I was having a panic attack. And they immediately jumped, a couple gentlemen jumped to help, to make sure that I was okay. And they stayed out of our way. They weren't on our face. What happened? What happened? It was nothing like that. They were very respectful and very controlled, which you would want in that scenario. So I'm very thankful for them putting their lives in their hands for me and everybody else.
Had you at your workplace done some kind of active shooter training? It sounded like you both in that room reacted very quickly, or was it just from hearing what happened in other incidents?
Just seemed like it was instinct. We never had shooter training. You wouldn't think, you know, everybody, you still don't think it'll ever happen in your workplace. But it just seemed like the strange instinct took over. And that's, we'll just be very quiet.
At some point, I don't think you've been back at the work site yet. At some point, you're going to be back at work. What's going through your head as you think about coming back into the building?
It's very difficult at the moment. Yesterday, we were able to collect our belongings. The police helped. They would go in the building to get the belongings. And the one offer, because I was having difficulty making it to the door, making it so I could get my stuff, but he drove my car over and got my belongings for me, and I was able to go. But it was hard driving to where we were going to meet to pick up our belongings. It was very difficult.
So now you've unfortunately been part of this story that we've seen so many times in the news. Do you feel like the world is different starting Wednesday?
Right now I want to say yes, but I want that world to be normal again. I don't want to be seen as a victim. I want to be seen as a survivor. And along with all of my other coworkers, we just did what we had to do. And there's no face. There's no, like, that's the monster. You don't know, but you have to live your life. You can't stop your life.
Christine, thank you so much for telling your story, and best to you, your coworkers, those recovering in the hospital now, and everybody who's been through this.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Christine Maltese is an employee at WTS Paradigm in Middleton. She talked with us about the shooting in her workplace this week that left three people seriously injured, the perpetrator dead after being shot by police officers. It's time now for our Wisconsin News Roundup, looking at some of the top stories from around the state. A political candidate had police called on her while campaigning. The husband of UW-Whitewater's chancellor has been accused of sexual harassment. And mosquitoes. Oh, the mosquitoes. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hi, Rob. Thank you.
Let's start with this story. We found out this week that Sheila Stubbs, an African-American woman running for the state assembly, had the police called on her, someone called the police on her while she was canvassing for votes last month. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened?
Sure. Stubbs is running for assembly, but she's also a current Dane County board member. And the assembly district has different kinds of neighborhoods in it, right? It has predominantly black neighborhoods, predominantly white neighborhoods, you know, more and less affluent. And so she was out knocking on doors and campaigning, meeting her to be her constituents. Oh, I should say she's running unopposed, so these are almost certain to be her future constituents. And in the course of this, in a white neighborhood, someone called police on her and said they suspected that that basically she was part of a drug deal, that she was at the local drug house waiting for drugs.
And they noted that she had a car full of people. As I understand it, her 70-some-year-old mother and her daughter were in the car.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's ridiculous, right? This is maybe the craziest detail in the story. Her 71-year-old mother and her 8-year-old daughter. So, like, this is within this group, and you know, she's dressed in, like, a business suit, essentially. So what is it exactly that made them look like drug dealers? It's not hard to reach the conclusion that it was about their race.
And what has Sheila Stubbs herself said about this and the interaction with police?
Well, so it is worth saying this is not just a claim by Stubbs. This was first reported by Jesse Opoyan of the Cap Times. She reviewed the complaint by, you know, that was made to police. The reporters have looked at the dash cam video from when the police were there. So Stubbs is talking, you know, straightforwardly talking about this as an instance of racial prejudice. And something that she felt humiliated by, and that is an example of this sort of, you know, sort of where we are right now in society. She said that the police officer who spoke with her, they ended up speaking with her for about 40 minutes in all between the conversation with her mother and with Stubbs herself, and said that the officer asked to see the actual voter list that she was working with, I guess, to verify that she was actually doing what she said she was doing.
Then moving on to this story at UW-Whitewater, Rob, Pete Hill, husband of University Chancellor Beverly Copper, banned from campus under investigation after a growing number of sexual harassment accusations. What's being alleged here?
Right. This was first reported last week on Friday, and some new details have come out since as well. But yes, Pete Hill is the husband of the chancellor. He was found to have an investigation found that he sexually harassed women who were campus employees. So he is accused of reaching down and squeezing a young woman's knee, like under a table during a dinner, a university dinner, inappropriate hugging and kissing, and at one university function, basically sort of pulling a woman close to him, whispering sexual comments, unwanted. I mean, it's gross stuff, but harassment allegations.
And what are people looking for now, not just from the husband of the chancellor, but the chancellor herself?
Well, this is exactly it. It is a big question hanging over this, is to what extent, if any, Copper should be considered culpable in any of this. You could certainly imagine a situation where she was aware of allegations or tried to cover them up or whatever, but it's a bit hard to say, at least at this point, whether that is true. The UW system released documents about Hill to Karen Herzog of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but initially in the first release did not include the fact that did not include information about investigators' interview with Copper, which obviously would shed some light on this sort of what was she aware of or what wasn't she aware of. There are some accusers in this case, as well as a state senator who represents Whitewater, who are calling on her to resign. She has not resigned.
And then briefly, Rob, we're all aware, I think, of the mosquitoes out there. Mosquitoes got involved in a case of Crime and Punishment. Can you sum that story up for us?
Yeah, I love it. The story from out of Fond du Lac by my colleague Sophie Carson. A guy was running away from the cops in the village of Campbellsport. He was accused of stealing a bunch of alcohol from a Piggly Wiggly, and he was running away, trying to get away in a cornfield, and it turned out that the mosquitoes were so bad that he surrendered. He came back out, mosquitoes swarming around his face, and he couldn't take it anymore, and that man was arrested.
All right, possibly a new police tactic in the works there. Rob, thanks for bringing us up to date.
All right, thank you.
Rob Mensah is a statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He joins us every week for a roundup of the top Wisconsin news stories. There's a lot at stake in the confirmation battle over Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. He's facing an accusation of sexual assault, which he has denied, but his opponents say the position is too important to rush the nomination through without getting to the bottom of it. One reason these fights are so consequential is because the justices serve lifetime appointments, and our next guest says that's part of a problem. Gabe Roth is executive director of the advocacy group Fix the Court. They're calling for term limits for Supreme Court justices, and they work on modernizing the federal court system. Gabe, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, make the basic case. What's wrong with life appointments for Supreme Court justices?
Sure. The justices now are serving longer than ever before. They're more powerful than ever before, not what our founders intended in terms of having unelected, unaccountable judges making these sweeping pronouncements for our country, for individuals across the country on issues like life and death, who wins our elections, who can vote, who can marry, healthcare, environment, etc. So in order to restore constitutional balance, to make them the Article III branch, and third most important once again, reducing their tenure from 20, 30, sometimes 35 years to a standard 18 years would restore constitutional balance, and it would also yield predictability and lower the temperature of the nomination fights, as you mentioned in the open.
Now, one, the basic case, I guess, for a lifetime appointment was, okay, once you're on the court, you don't have to worry about political pressure from outside forces. Nobody is renewing your job. You don't have to worry about the next gig after you get off the Supreme Court.
Sure.
It's a life job. You are free of political influence. Isn't that something worth preserving?
It is, but I think if you look at the justices who've recently retired, even Justice Kennedy gave a talk at a has been giving talks since he retired to different legal groups. You have Justice Souter, who retired a few years ago, I think in 2009, and sometimes he sits on a lower court up in New England. Justice O'Connor, who retired in 2005, she has sat on lower courts out in Arizona, and she's also started a civics group. John Paul Stevens has testified before Congress and written books. So former justices, I think, do have a role to play as sort of senior statesmen within our democracy. But there's no reason that any of the individuals I mentioned or any of the eight individuals currently sitting on the court should be able to hold on to their power that makes our federal judiciary look more like feudalism than a modern democracy.
You mentioned the term limit idea. You have a more fleshed out plan. People can see that on your website, but talk to us about how you see this working.
Sure. So you would add, America would add a justice every 2 years, and the nomination would come up in the summer of odd numbered years. So when the court is out of session, they take 3 months off during the summer, and odd numbered years are the years in which there is no congressional election. So what you would have is some sort of predictability, so you're not waiting to see, based on actuarial tables and justices' illnesses or who happens to win the presidency. There's not this gamesmanship going on, and you know that every odd-numbered summer there's going to be another justice added, and then they'll rotate off after 18 years.
How do we get from—so this, first of all, would take a constitutional amendment. It's a
Maybe.
Tall order. Oh, that's right. There is another way. Let's start there with how this could
sure.
be
so,
put in place.
Sure. So, legal scholars are split on whether or not this would take a constitutional amendment. Obviously, it could happen with a constitutional amendment. I prefer a legislative fix where the term that the judges, both superior and inferior, shall hold their offices during good behavior, as it says in the Constitution. So offices, from my view, means the office of federal judge. So you are a federal judge for life, however, only 18 years of which would you be able to sit on the Supreme Court. And then what Congress would do is they would just pass a law that you'd add a new justice every year. So eventually you'd get to 9 justices, 18 years, but for the first 15 or 20 years of this plan, you may have an odd year here or there with 10 or 11 justices. So that's the legislative way to do it, a lot easier than I think a constitutional amendment-based fix.
Now, one concern people bring up is, as you mentioned, that justice might try to time their retirement to, go with a president who's going to replace them with somebody of their philosophy.
Might. I mean, it's happening.
Right. That's how it tends to work. So if I'm a justice, I've got this 18-year term, couldn't I duck out year 15 and create the same problem?
That's possible. I mean, so the law that I've proposed with legal scholars across the board is the justice who has most recently retired would then be pulled back into service. So in the case of, just to use the Antonin Scalia example, so if Scalia passes away and the Republicans don't want to confirm Merrick Garland during that, I don't remember what it was, something like 400-day period where there was only 8 justices, there would actually be a 9th justice, and that would be the justice who most recently retired would have the opportunity to be pulled back into service, which I think would have been John Paul Stevens, and he's still kicking in fully there at 97. So he would have had the ability to become the 9th justice based on some policy maneuvering and votes and whatnot and legislative language. But you wouldn't have a situation where, okay, to your point, if a justice leaves after 15 years, you wouldn't have this even number of justices until 3 years hence.
And your plan sees a role for the former justices, not just, as I understand it, as the backups if a Supreme Court justice should retire or die before their term ended. You see them being involved in other ways in the federal court.
Sure. I think the biggest example is if there is a case that needs to be decided in a certain finite amount of time. I mean, think about Bush v. Gore 2 or, I don't know, you know, Pence v. Booker or whatever it would be, that where you need a definitive answer, then, and then there are only 8 justices. Imagine, you know, Kavanaugh doesn't get confirmed and you have 8 justices for a while. If we were in a situation where there was this one generational case that needed to be decided, then a recently retired justice could be pulled back into service. So there are certain scenarios where you would need to have an odd number of justices to get to a 5, well, hopefully a 9-0 decision, right? You want the justices to be unified, but given this hyper-partisan time, it's unlikely. So yeah, there would be some cases where retired justice would be pulled back into service.
Talking to Gabe Roth from the group Fix the Court, he and his organization and legal scholars working with them are calling for a different way of setting up our Supreme Court with limited terms, 18-year terms for each justice. Gabe, either way we got from here to there, constitutional amendment or the legislative plan you outlined, would require really huge bipartisan cooperation on this issue. Do you think there's enough desire for this in the United States to make that happen?
I think there is. I mean, I think if you just look at the grassroots level, there are groups. I mean, my group's nonpartisan, but I work with groups on the left and the right that support this fix. The two most influential legal groups on the left and the right, the Federalist Society on the right and American Constitution Society on the left, the ideas that I'm working with came from a lot of the top scholars in those groups. I think, you know, one of the challenges of this is if you were like 5 years ago when I did polling or 4 years ago when Obama was in office, there were way more Republicans who wanted term limits than Democrats. Now it's the opposite. So when you ask Americans writ large, you know, what do you think about term limits? A lot of times they're thinking about their own presidents nominating and their own senators giving advice and consent. But overall, if you take the larger picture, this is something that is a popular policy proposal across the board. And the longer we go without it, the larger a chance that a justice with mental decline, a la William Douglas, who stayed on the court for 9 years after, he, or sorry, 9 months after he had a debilitating stroke, that becomes more and more likely. So if there was sort of a constitutional crisis and a justice who was infirm, I think there could be a confluence of events that could lead to this. And very quickly, given the popularity of this policy with the American people, I think both parties could come together and say, look, you know, Congress needs to reestablish its Article I role, and we need to rein in the power of the justices.
One case I've heard from some people is that we have kind of an absurd system now where there's an incentive for a president to find not just the right ideological justice, but the youngest possible. And then, as you were talking about earlier, the incentive for justices to stay, they might be 80 something and not want to retire based on who might replace them. Does your plan kind of help fix that at both ends?
I think so. I mean, there are folks on Trump's shortlist. You know, he came out with this list of there's been several iterations of it, but I think we're up to 25 people on his shortlist now. I think there's a guy on there who's like 37 or 38, and that's a couple years older than me. And I can tell you right now, I'm in no way ready to be a Supreme Court justice. So yeah, I think the idea that you have the baby justices or the baby justice in waiting, potentially, you know, rising to that level. I mean, Clarence Thomas was only 43 when he was nominated. I think, you know, there are plenty of jurists in America, someone like Wisconsin's Diane Sykes, who has been talked about as a potential, she's on the short list, but I read an article today saying, oh, you know, if Kavanaugh withdraws, she's too old to be considered, which to me is crazy. I mean, I just was able to watch her preside over a case now that the Seventh Circuit, you know, the regional appeals court that comprises Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana, they now have video, thanks, I think, to a lot of my lobbying efforts, which is another one of our prongs. But, you know, she's doing fine. Like, she could absolutely serve for 18 years. And the fact that because she's 60, she's considered too old and she's very well respected in conservative circles, I mean, I think that's ridiculous.
In presidential elections in particular, to a lesser extent, Senate elections, this the appointment power of a Supreme Court justice and confirmation power seems like it's gotten bigger and bigger over the years, maybe leading people to decide their vote for a candidate they wouldn't even like just for that one reason. Does the term limit idea, you think, take some of that heat off?
That I'm not sure about. You know, I've thought about that, and I think that, you know, there are a lot of different things at play when you think about who to vote for president. I think, you know, exit polls show that Republicans were more motivated to vote for Trump versus Democrats and Hillary because of the Supreme Court issue. You know, I think that maybe now with the Kavanaugh nomination and all the issues surrounding that, I think maybe, you know, there's a little bit more parity between the parties. But, you know, almost every president, at least in my lifetime, has had several Supreme Court justices to nominate. I mean, Jimmy Carter is the last president not to nominate anyone. And so I think people sort of get it now, and that's all part of it. But, you know, the idea that this is more predictable, theoretically, at least I believe, would reduce the temperature of each nomination, knowing that we're going to be doing this every couple of years, and you know, spending all this political capital on one specific, you know, on the Kennedy seat, as it's been called, for example, like that shouldn't happen. You know, once we're used to doing this sort of thing every couple of years. I mean, the biggest issue, you know, one of the things that prompted this is we had this 11-year period recently where there were no nominations between Breyer in 94 and Roberts in 2005. There were no new justices added. So when Roberts came around, it was a much bigger deal than it should have been. I mean, granted, you know, Chief Justice Rehnquist died around the time he was nominated, so that also added to it. But and the whole Myers, Harry Myers debacle. But, you know, overall, having something more frequently, I think the populace would get more used to this and would lower the temperature of each individual nomination.
Briefly, as we wrap up, is this going to happen, you think, in your lifetime?
I'm young and I eat well, so I exercise a lot. So, you know, I think so. I mean, I think it's only a matter of time. This is something that the grassroots on the left and the right is really excited about. I think term limits brings more transparency. We know more about our justices if we have, you know, more frequent nominations, and it's an opportunity to engage civically. And I think that's something the younger generation is going to like. And the idea of you know, serving this feudal amount of time is just not something that that makes sense anymore, and not something that I think our founders would have wanted. So yeah, I think it's an idea whose time has come.
We'll leave it there. Gabe, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Gabe Roth with the nonpartisan advocacy group Fix the Courts, with us to talk about the idea of term limits for Supreme Court justices.